Segundo here, and I'm feeling very perplexed. You see, I signed onto this MySpace thing, and I'm astonished that people don't want to be my friend. What have I done to you? I haven't run over your cocker spaniel. I've been quite nice and understanding. But perhaps they're remembering the incident from 1986, and they're holding a grudge. I want to assure these duplicitous rabble-rousers who wish to tarnish my reputation that my pants were quite zipped and my spirit quite unsullied and also unzipped. This is in the past. I was sober, innocent, and well outside the realm of culpability, and I'll leave it at that. Anyway, that's not important. This week's guest is Edward P. Jones, a man who I'm sure understands the oppression that I feel. He understands these things, and he would never judge me for a crime that I have long since been proven innocent from.
So I am honored to be here with Edward Jones, who is the author of the novel The Known World, and most recently a short story collection, the second, called Ol and Hagar's Children. Ed, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Fantastic first name you got there.
Well, what can you say?
I gotta say. I wanted to actually open up with something that I've observed in most of your stories, and that is you're very into specifics. For example, the addresses and the streets within these stories are as much of a character as everything else. I'm wondering if this was a holdover from your days editing a tax magazine,
or is this an
instinct for precision that you have?
The work at that Tax Notes has nothing to do with my life.
Sure.
Nothing whatsoever. No, I just like to be specific, that's all. Mm-hmm. People live in a particular place, and you should make note of where that is. I've read things where people will say so-and-so went to the university and never specify what university is. So that's just the way I like to do it.
What is it about specifics that you feel kind of convey character or convey the
human? Well, it doesn't really convey a character, but it tells, and probably won't say anything to the majority of people who might read the stories, but to anyone who knows Washington, born and raised in Washington, they will know it as a particular place. So it's just a sort of quirk I have. That's all. I suppose that's the best way I can say it.
Okay. Well, the concern, though, for details is very interesting to me because it often extends into minor characters. I mean, I think also of the guy screaming in the jail cell in A Rich Man, the cop who's reading the newspaper with a magnifying glass in Common Law. I almost get the sense when I read your stories that you would continually invent or keep on creating if you could. What steps do you take to sort of manage your imagination or to kind of...
I don't. There's nothing you can do. You just live your life. I'm not sure I can analyze how I do it. I simply do it.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of the cop in the car, he has glasses on. Not only has glasses on, but he has to use a magnifying glass. But I think that what I often say is if you have a portrait painted of your family and they're at the center of the portrait, there's no use having cartoonish figures in the background. What's in the background, what's to the side, should be as rich in detail as the family in the foreground, right there in the center of the portrait. And I suppose that's part of it. It's all a matter of trying to make the reader believe that what he or she is reading is real, actually happened. Even though, of course, it all came out of my imagination.
Well, family lineage, you often refer to people as mother's mother and father's uncle. I don't think I really encountered, I think maybe there was one story that didn't actually have that kind of level of family. And I'm wondering, is this kind of a guide for you when you sort of concoct these stories in your head? Or, how does family kind of tie into this quirk of yours?
No, I think that's the same thing, trying to be detailed and specific.
Yeah.
I don't make any sort of chart in my mind before I do that. I work the stories out in my head from the beginning to the end in a general way, not in any detailed way. And in the writing of it, then details that I had never thought about come into play. Like, so-and-so's mother and all of that.
Well, Squirrel Nuts actually makes 3 appearances, I counted, in the
story.
Yeah,
I liked Squirrel Nuts when I was a kid, and I can't, Mary Jane's appears a lot, that candy.
Yeah.
I like Murray James, but not as much as I like Squirrel Nuts.
I think, though, the interesting thing about the appearance of squirrel nuts is that it's always tied into pennies being slid across the counter. Mm. So it's always a very specific connotation of...
They were only a penny when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was all penny candy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good memory of that. Because, I mean, it was easy enough to find bottles and cash them in for a nickel and, you know, you had some candy.
I actually wanted to ask you about handicapped people or people who have their legs or wounded legs. This is a common sort of thing I observed throughout all the stories.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why this...
I didn't notice that. I mean, I haven't... And one thing I always say is that I'm not the best judge of my work.
Sure.
I'm not the best analyst of it. So there are things going on, and all I'm doing is telling a story. Now, someone can come along later and say, you know, I see this, I see that repeated. I see this theme, I see that theme. But I'm not the best person to sit to talk about that, I suppose.
Mm.
It's the fact that there are handicapped people is in there. I guess I never really, I knew there were, you know, two stories with two blind people. I knew that. But and there's a guy, I think he was wounded in World War II. But yeah, you're saying it now is the first time I ever really thought about it.
Well, there's also, in two stories, you have a very specific kind of image where someone actually goes out to sea. It's actually the first two stories in the collection. And they come back and they're either, you know, they have some sort of savings. And I don't know, it just, it happens so frequently. I was wondering, do you feel that this is a kind of way for you to kind of concoct conflict or to sort of... Sketching.
No, I think in the first instance, the guy was at sea for a long time, and he comes back and he becomes blind. That's again just a lot of background to the primary story of this newly married couple.
Yeah.
You know, they can't exist in a vacuum all to themselves, so you try to create stories that are in the background to the side of the main characters, and that was it. That's what I came up with. The same thing with the second story, where there's a guy. I think you're talking about the guy who was at sea, and then he came on. He had strokes.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with that is, the father is a primary figure in that particular story. The second story, Spanish in the Morning. I had to have a situation where he would have a little bit more backyard space than his own house provides. So the guy next door had to be in a position where he couldn't really plant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that is to simply have him be ill. And that was what I came up with in that instance.
I wanted to talk about two stories in this that actually concern themselves, again, a similar pattern I noted, with gifted students in both the Poor Guatemalan and Spanish in the Morning. Are there sort of specific kinds of recurrent kinds of things that you kind of feel that, like, say, with one story that you haven't actually fleshed it out to the best of your, you know, to your satisfaction, and what you feel the need to kind of do another riff on it?
There were two separate.
Yeah, I mean, they're distinct, but when like a minor element like this comes out.
You know? No, the focus was on, in the first story, the Spanish in the Morning, was on a girl who had to make the decision down the line that, she knew the world was, perhaps she was realizing the world was not a nice place. And the best way for me to have her come to that decision was have her to be an above average student, which means she had an above average mind. And that was it. That was it. In the other story, Poor Guatemalan Dreams of a Downtown in Peru, I had to have someone intelligent, I suppose, to survive all the horrors that she went through. And that was it. But they were always two distinct stories.
Sure.
There was never an attempt to do something that I hadn't done in the first story.
I guess what I'm sort of asking is, even though they are two different tales, and they're these tales, all of your tales have sort of multiple components to them, I'm wondering if you feel that coming back to sort of a recurrent thing, like for example, someone who is handicapped or someone who is gifted, that working on that particular component in another story allows you to sort of broaden it?
Because every story is distinct. I mean, it's as if when I finish one story, my mind is erased and I go on to something new. It's never an attempt to revisit something. Never. My mind doesn't think that way. And I suppose, you know, I'm aware of people who have handicaps and all of that, and maybe that's why they're in the stories. But no, I never think theme-wise. You know, again, that's for someone else to come along and say, yeah, there are themes there. But every single story is distinct to itself. And, you know, because you are just the person that you are, you can't help but bring in things that you've done before.
Sure, sure. Well, in terms of, like, you know, wiping your mind clean, as you mm-hmm. say, I mean, what steps do you take to sort of ensure that, you know, your inventive prowess is reset back to zero? Mm.
Well, there's nothing you can do, really. You know, I'm now and again, when I see stuff I've done, I can see a phrase here and there that's repeated, but it's you try to recall all the stuff that you've done, but it's impossible to recall everything. My only hope is that I don't repeat the major things. Mm-hmm. The major things, yeah, but the small things, yeah, I'll let a phrase go here and there. It's inevitable.
It's not only that, but it's also the fact that, like, a lot of characters from your first collection, yeah. Caesar Returns.
Yeah, that was deliberate, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't, when I finished Lost in the City, the first book, I hadn't intended to go back to any of those people. Mm-hmm. And 3 years later, things began to come to me, and I just followed the string that was unreeling in my head.
Do you often revisit your work in the past?
Or
do
no.
you feel that kind of corrupts...
No, yeah. No, I don't. I mean, the only old stuff I go back to is when I'm called upon to read.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I gave the last reading ever from the known world I was in Canada, and so I probably will never read from that again. But that's the only going back that I do. And when you're sitting there waiting to start reading, I'll flip through the pages and everything, but I never pick up Lost in the City and say, let's see what I did. I did that with the new stories, only because I wanted to get the names right, and that was it.
Huh. So it was a matter of, like, you know, clarifying details that you hadn't clarified the previous.
Well, yeah, like in the first story, in All Antigua's Children, it's I'm losing my mind now. In the blink of God's eye,
yeah.
I wanted to see if I had given Miles's parents names. In the first story in Lost in the City, the girl who raised pigeons.
Yeah.
And they had no names. So I invented names for In the Blink of God's Eye. But that was it. That was it. You know, just to make sure the details here and there were correct.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, the stories in this collection, In the Blink of God's Eye, actually starts in 1901, and they mm-hmm. extend across various sort of points of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, at what point, when you're sort of envisioning a story, does the sort of time frame kind of come into play? When do you decide, oh, well, something set in 1901 versus something set in 1955?
Well, in the case of In the Blink of God's Eye, I was, when I realized that I was dealing with characters from Lost in the City, you know, I had to sort of make the time right. So the previous story, the first story in Lost in the City, The Girl Who Raised Pigeons, it's about 1955, and Miles is 55 years old. So when I invented this story where he's a baby and the woman who becomes his mother finds him wrapped in blankets hanging from a tree, if he's a baby, then I have to go back to 1901. I can't make it 1935 or 1940.
Yeah.
So that's why it's 1901. There's another story that takes place, the last story, as a matter of fact, Tapestry, that takes place in 1932 and 1933. Well, I wanted to be able to say that the woman had lived a certain amount of years to become a great-great-grandmother.
Yeah.
And that would not have worked if I had put it, you know, later. Almost all the stories, when I think of stories, they come to me and it's the 1950s or the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really come into the 1980s and 1990s. It's almost always 1950s, 1960s. Unless I have to have a reason, like in Lost in the City, the story, his mother's house, the guy is dealing drugs, and so that would have to be like 1970s, 1980s.
Why do you think that period of the 50s and the 60s is so dear to you, and so the sort of nexus of imagination?
I think it's because I was, you know, I was coming of age. I grew up, I was born in 1950, and, you know, you're discovering the world about you,
mm-hmm.
And all of that goes into that. So, I mean, everything before 1950 isn't quite clear in my mind, so I can't really imagine a world like that. I have to really work for that, which is why there are only two stories that really probably take place before 1950.
Yeah.
But no, it's, you know, I can remember a lot of things growing up from the 1950s and 1960s. In 1968, I went away to college. And then 72, I came out and I was in Washington, but it wasn't, you know, there was nothing that stuck to me like it did when I was growing up.
We're going back, I'm going to go back to the squirrel nuts thing in terms of like, is your fiction a way for you to kind of re-explore your own sort of...
No, no. There's no catharsis, no therapy. It's all just imaginary stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not working... You know, it might be that the mind is working away on a certain level that I'm not aware of. But again, the thing is, I am not aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to tell a story, and that's as simple as it gets for me.
Washington, D.C. Is where many of the characters in this flee, or actually rather are attracted to. It's this almost magnetic kind of point where everyone goes to.
Well,
and I'm wondering why you view, I mean, obviously you've lived in Washington, D.C. For quite some time, but why is it this sort of magnetic nexus point for many of the stories?
Well, it's because it's where I was born and raised.
Yeah.
Had I been born in Chicago, then the characters in all Aunt Hager's children would... I would have found a way for them to get to Chicago.
Yeah.
If I had been born in some town in New Jersey, that's what it would have been. So Washington is where I was born. It's what I know.
Yeah.
I wanted to write a lot of the stories and have them deal with people who somehow found their way to Washington, and that was it. I mean, Washington's a special place only because it's my hometown. But other than that, no. It's a background for a lot of the stories. It's a place that I know.
So for any location that you set your stories in, you feel the need to really sort of steep yourself in terms of addresses and locales?
Well,
and, you know.
Yeah, and, well, in Washington. But that's because a lot of those streets I've walked down, you know, as a kid, not so much as an adult, but as a kid, I know the streets. And in the known world, it's an imaginary county, and I suppose if I had, you know, decided to place it in a real place, the novel, then perhaps I would have come up with addresses for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Washington had been a place of plantations, I would have set the novel there.
Yeah.
But I had no choice but to put it in an area where there were plantations once upon a time.
Did you find stepping outside of, you know, something you were intimately familiar with, like Washington, D.C., instead of imagining this whole thing in Virginia, was this more of a challenge for you to invent locales as opposed to have the specific things that you were familiar with?
Yeah, no, because I mean, I'm specific in places in the known world, but otherwise it's not as specific as in Washington, you know. So-and-so in Manchester, the town of Manchester, doesn't walk down the street with a name. I don't think I gave any of the streets names.
Yeah.
I didn't have any trouble because I was concentrating more on the characters.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of the reasons why I never did any research about American slavery. The characters, if something told me, should come first.
You often have a sort of interesting story device where we suddenly sort of flash forward to the, we were talking about this in Tapestry, and it certainly happens a lot in the known world, where we sort of flash forward to a character's fate.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, and it often happens at a sort of moment in which, anyway, for me, I always feel off guard when that happens, and it's a very interesting sort of thing that is, it almost in its own way, kind of violates the natural flow of the narrative. I mean, what do you feel that this is your own way of placing things or throwing the reader off guard?
Oh, no, never throw the reader off guard, because if you throw the reader off guard, then the imaginary world you're trying to create dissolves. The only way I can explain it is what I've been coming to sort of realize in answering questions about that kind of thing is that I suppose I see time as just one line, and past, present, and future, and if you're writing about a character, then you can pluck any point on that line and inform the reader about the character. And that's what it is. No, the thing I never want to do is just throw the reader off guard, because then, you know, it's like writing, you know, 1930s, and people are driving around and go to a filling station and they pull into an Exxon station rather than an Esso station.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of just, it kills everything. So, no, it was never that. I just, when I, you know, started doing it, I read it over to make sure that it was smooth reading, you know, that the reader could read, come to that point and make the jump and then continue reading the story.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to actually talk again about the sort of exactitude of your stories. Like, for example, there's a lot of it in Old Boys, Old Girls where you have, like, the size... A living room is the size of 10 prison cells.
Yeah.
Or the Yvonne's room being a third larger than Caesar's room. And so it's certainly a lot different from a lot of other stories that I've read. And I'm wondering, again, I guess, why be sort of that exact?
I don't... You know, I can only say that, you know, yesterday someone in L.A. asked me in the story Common Law, why did you say she was an only child? I can't answer that. You know, you're telling the story and, you know, you're imagining this, and there are a number of facts you can choose in the imagination, and that just happens to be the ones that I'm talking about. The first thing you talked about, Caesar's room being such and such a size, relationship to the cell, is because he has been a prisoner for a lot of years.
Certainly.
And so, of course, he will sort of measure things by the cell that he lived in for all those years. But I think, you know, again, it's, you know, it's all made up, and so you have to grab things that will hold the reader, you know. And the very fact, maybe that you mentioned that says that, you know, the story was made real for you even more because I said things like that.
It was certainly real, but it was also very interestingly mathematical, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't explain much beyond that. Her room was the size it was.
You know, some people sort of describe it like, you know, oh, well, it reminded me of... They don't relate to a room necessarily in terms of size. They might relate to it in terms of, like, decor or, like, you know, whether it's clean or dingy.
Yeah.
You know, and yet in this case, it was very mathematical, and it was more, like, oriented around space. And that seems a very interesting preference.
Yeah, it may have been because, like I said, he spent all his years in a cell, you know. And not only in a cell, but in a place where you can go here, but you can't go beyond that particular point.
Sure.
And that may well have been it. You know, there are things you do when you're telling a story that, again, you're not always aware of, you know. Your whole job is simply to tell a story that a reader will believe and become involved in. Mm-hmm. She said, you know, why did you say she was a middle child? Well, I didn't know how to answer that. It's a fact of the story. It's a fact that she was an only child.
Yeah. Or like, you know, in the case of the first story, being the middle child and having three on one side and three on the other.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, yeah.
But again, this is, again, what I'm sort of suggesting, this whole mathematical thing, three on one side, three on another. You know?
Well, I don't know. Well, I think I wanted her that happened because I think it was maybe four on each side. I'm not sure. Maybe it's three. But
It may have actually been four. I think you're right. Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's in that case, I wanted to be able to, I forget the phrase, something about she knew men and they were not gods. And in order to do that, I mean, she had two brothers. But if you have four on either side and a father, you have nine men in your life, you know, and you know them, you know. Nine is better than saying there were three men in her life. That's probably where that came from.
Yeah.
And I wanted her in the sort of center of that whole thing.
Yeah, sure.
And I started college as a math major, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? Okay.
I did well with math in high school, and I thought I would become a math major, and I took the calculus course, but I was very shy, and I was in this new white environment, and I didn't have glasses, and I sat in the back of the room, and so I fell behind. I think I escaped with a D. So I said, well, you like to read, so you may as well become an English major. And that was it.
When you were growing up, was math and... I mean, what's the relationship between, I guess, mathematics and reading to you?
No, it wasn't any relation. I mean, I was okay in math before high school. Then I did very well.
Yeah.
But reading was always there. The comic books and then full-fledged real books without pictures. But no, I mean, I discovered I had the facility for math when I got to high school, and that was it. So,
okay.
And I thought I would be a math major, and I don't know, maybe. But that calculus, the professor was not good. He would just come in and just write on the board his back to the students.
Yeah.
And he would do that for practically the entire period.
Did you feel discouraged from pursuing reading as your first choice when you were, you know...
Reading?
I mean, in terms of, like, you know, you eventually went to get an MFA. And
yeah.
Why didn't you go over the MFA first? That's, I mean,
oh, because I didn't think about any MFA.
Okay.
I didn't think about that. I thought about journalism school, but then my mother became ill, and so I took care.
Yeah.
I think I was accepted to two schools, but I didn't go. So that was it. But no, and then I got this job with Science Magazine where all day I just called professors and scientists all day, and I got that in 76, and in 79 I said, well, you know, I think that James Allen McPherson was at University of Virginia.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, you don't have a family, you know, this is a nowhere job, so why not pursue the degree?
I actually wanted to talk about how you often present what I would kind of identify as double metaphors. In the known world, for example, you have the storms that are inside Robbins's head, mm-hmm. as well as the storms that actually, you know, plague Virginia. There is also, it kind of relates to that, or it seems similar to me, like a common sort of pendulum metaphor where you have a horse's tail flap one way or the other. And it's there's these kinds of double metaphors I often sort of find in your work, and I'm wondering, are these things that, you know, you're sort of pursuing a second time in an effort to kind of...
No, those things are all in my attempt to make the story look real. Uh-huh. I mean, I could have said he was sitting on the horse, and then he sauntered off. But what you discover, you know, is that the more detail you present, the better for the reader. Mm-hmm. And so having the tale do this and that is part of that, you know. Just saying, you know, the horse is there, what kind of horse and everything, but you add a little bit more, you know. It's just more and more detail that you try to help the reader with.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you can say the table is such and such a size, it's a small table, but if you say it was big enough to hold a lamp, a cup of coffee, and a Bible, then, you know, that's better than saying it was a small table.
You've said repeatedly that you want to help the reader out, and I'm wondering, do you have a circle of people read your stories?
No, I'm the only person I rely on.
Really?
You know, I mean, if you start having people read the work, then they come back with this opinion and that opinion, and then before you know it, you're working for them.
Yeah.
You know, so and that's why I tell people, you know, you should read as much as you can, and then get a sense of what is good and what's not good. And then when you start writing your own work, you know, you can apply the knowledge you have. So, no, it's, I don't share my work with anybody, and I don't have any particular reader, you know, in mind. I try to satisfy myself, first and foremost.
Obviously, you had the MFA workshop situation where you had that kind of environment. Is this one of the reasons you kind of... shied away from other people?
No, because they didn't have any sort of philosophy there.
Yeah.
You know, the three writing people there didn't have any philosophy. And, you know, when I went there, I was about 28, 29, so I already had a sense of the kind of style I would develop.
Yeah.
And even I think if they had had a certain philosophy, I'm not sure I would have followed it. You know, the three writing professors knew enough to know you can't tell writers to do this and do that, you know, because again, you're dealing with the imagination.
What would you identify as your philosophy?
I don't say again. Those are things that I don't think I even think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I have any sort of philosophy. Tell the best story that you can possibly tell is about as close as I can get. You know?
Hey, but it's still a philosophy.
Yeah, but it's. Probably that's the first time I ever said that.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I ever thought of that, so because I didn't have any philosophy.
Yeah. I wanted to actually ask you about the family again, and you were talking about this, the sort of, you know, reference points for the reader and for you. Mm. But it also, to me, it's sort of reminiscent of, you know, saying something like mother's mother or father's father is like very close to Faulkner or Russian literature even, where they did that quite a lot. And I was wondering if
there's a lot of that in the Bible.
Yeah, and the Bible, of course, yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
But I'm wondering, you know, at the end of In the Blink of God's Eye, you have you use Ruth's husband in a particular way that really sort of sells what has basically, you know, happened to this.
Yeah,
guy, you
know? Yeah. Well, he doesn't. I think he at that point he realizes how much he loves her, and that his name is Aubrey, but after he leaves that Caesar there with the dogs, he's never referred to as Aubrey. It's only he or Ruth's husband, because that's what he is. You know, his she has his heart. You know, he belongs to her, and I don't think he realized completely how much that was so until he went out there. I mean, at the end there, there's a separation, but for those who have read the first story in Lost in the City, Miles' parents are there, and my thought is that that's Ruth and Aubrey.
Violence is something that I see in almost every story of yours. Mm-hmm. I kind of sort of suggested that, you know, that some of the elements that you include in your stories are, you know, like such as the handicapped element is a way for you to kind of kickstart conflict. But I wanted to ask about how violence kind of, why this is sort of a good mode for you to design a story, or why this
I don't know. I mean, again, I think probably because it's part of a drama thing.
Sure.
You know, that's probably why it enters into. And it's a violent world, you know. If I were writing about people on a farm, you know, who just raised cotton, for example, and there was this one guy, then there might not be any violence, perhaps, you know. But we're dealing with an urban environment, for the most part, and things like that happen.
Sure.
And things like that happen.
But it seems to almost happen with every story. There is some really... Yes, it is a violent world, but I'm wondering why, you know... Why violence in particular? Why hitting? I mean, like, you know, why? Why?
I don't have an answer for that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Sorry.
Actually, I wanted to ask, because these stories are so designed, I was wondering if you were a crossword puzzle fan.
No, I'm... The last time I was able to do crosswords was in the 60s, and we would get the Sunday paper, and then there would be a crossword in there about TV. Mm-hmm. And I could do that pretty well because I watch a lot of TV.
Yeah.
I'm unable to do, you know, I mean, the first clue, I have no idea.
Yeah.
So, no, I haven't done a crossword since the 60s.
Okay. I was wondering if there are any other sort of things you might do to kind of at least keep your sort of storytelling instincts strong.
No, because, I don't know where it comes from, so I don't know what feeds it. And therefore, you just live your life the way you've always lived it.
Do you feel that if you were to sort of abruptly change the way you live, that the storytelling instinct would either be dramatically shifted or possibly dissipate? Or?
No, I don't worry about that. I mean, you know, if I started living in a mansion, you know, I would still be the same person, essentially.
Yeah.
I'm still believing the same things. So, I have no fear about that.
You're talking a little bit about this, but I also read an interview that you did with the site after the MFA, and you indicated that you never experiment. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what the process of development is for you in terms of, you know, being able to sort of concoct stories, because, I mean, I guess evolution implies some kind of experimentation or taking some kinds of chances.
I don't know. I mean, I do know that the stories in All on Hager's Children are longer than the ones in Lost in the City, and that just my effort to make stories read as if they're novels, and that's about all I know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as a rule, don't really experiment, because I think that you know, for example, you know, stories that are second person, you know, it just seems to me that it's an effort to sort of pull the reader in because you have a weak story. Mm-hmm. And my belief is that, you know, if it's a good story, then there you are. Once upon a time, this happened, and then that happened. And there you are. You know, you don't need a lot of fancy language. You don't need second person.
What about, like, you know, varying length you were describing? I mean, that's certainly some kind of experimentation in the sense that the details are becoming more, they're evolving, or they're becoming sort of more elaborate or intricate or baroque?
Well, no, you're still within the space of a story.
Okay.
You know, they never verge into being novellas, for example. So, I'd never consider myself an experimenter. You know, I think good old-fashioned storytelling is good enough.
There's a lot of miracles also that crop up in this, too, and the faith versus science question as well. I'm wondering... You do it in a way that I'm not really a big fan of magical realism, but you do it in a way that at least casts a certain amount of kind of doubt upon whether it is a miracle and whether the miracle is actually the perception of other characters viewing it as a miracle.
Do you have an example? Did you know?
I'm trying to think. It's the story that was set, you know, I think it's Poor Guatemalan, I want to say.
Yeah, but yeah, but that's... I think probably in the 60s there was a magazine called Psychology Today, and they had an article in there about children, for example, who just go through these horrendous situations, and yet they grew up to be, you know, adults with no problems.
Sure.
And probably that's where the story started. Of course, in the 60s, I had no idea about being a writer. But I think that article still stuck with me. And so I was interested in what happens to someone who goes through life and they escape situation after situation where other people are killed. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was it. It wasn't really a miracle sort of thing or a magical realism sort of thing that I was thinking about. It was just the idea that someone could go through that and what happens, you know, to them. That was it.
Okay.
Was that the question that we were getting at?
It was sort of that. I guess what I mean is a suspension of disbelief in relation to
the
miracle.
I know, and I had a concern about that.
Yeah.
You know, and I just said, you know, you have to go with it, you know. She goes to one thing after another.
Yeah.
You know, and but of course that's what fiction is, you know, you have to sort of believe it. I said maybe one or two things, but there are a lot of things. But I think the thing ultimately I was with the story as well is, you know, this thing that human beings have to simply go on no matter what happens. And that's when she sees that road there in Peru.
Yeah.
And meets two other people who have encountered the same sort of situations. That, you know, loved ones are killed, loved ones die, you know. But the fact that we are here means that they will still live. And that was it. That was it, you know. And to get there, I had to do this stuff with miracle after miracle. I couldn't help it.
Yeah. I'll ask you one last question because I don't want your friend to be worried. But when you have multiple characters in a story, is this a kind of way to sort of ensure that you have this sort of really broad array of perspectives concerning one event? I think of... is it common law that's the story about the guy who's the neighbor... I want to say it's common law.
No, that's the one about the abusive boyfriend.
Yeah, the abusive boyfriend. That's what I mean. That story, to me, works so well because you have so many people perceiving and reacting to the situation.
Yeah.
In all kinds of different ways.
Yeah.
And in this sense, it kind of like, you know, allows for a certain kind of broad expanse of humanity to kind of...
Well, I wanted to show a neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, this common place. And their reactions to what is going on with this couple. There's this little girl who reacts most dramatically, of course.
Yeah.
And what happens? That was it. I just wanted to show a neighborhood. And you know, you can't. You know, if you want to show a neighborhood of kids and families, you can't just do five people, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, you have to expand in order to show the reader that there are a lot of people on these two streets.
Yeah.
That was it.
But it's also very much about not just the neighborhood, but the reactions of these people and the way that they're like horrified by what this guy's doing.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But some of them react to it and some of them don't.
Yeah.
And the major reaction is, of course, this fainting by the little girl.
Yeah.
And then at the end, this little boy likes her so much, his attempt to drive the evil out of her life.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, and I really don't want you to be late, but it was a great pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.